the whole people must be wiped out of existence. These vile words come from a noble citizen of one of the most civilized nation-states of its time, the home of philosophy, jurisprudence, and classical drama. We live in the mass murder century. More than 50 million people have been systematically murdered by government decrees enacted by soldiers and civilian forces willing to carry out the kill orders. Beginning in 1915, Ottoman Turks slaughtered 1.5 million Armenians. The mid-20th century saw the Nazis liquidate at least 6 million Jews, 3 million Soviet POWs, 2 million Poles, and hundreds of thousands of undesirable peoples. As Stalin's Soviet Empire murdered 20 million Russians, Mao Zedong's government policies resulted in an even greater number of deaths, up to 30 million of the country's own citizens. The communist Khmer Rouge regime killed off 1.7 million people of its own nation in Cambodia. Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party is accused of killing 100,000 Kurds in Iraq. In 2006, genocide has erupted in Sudan's Darfur region, which most of the world has conveniently ignored. Note that almost exactly the same words that Agamemnon used three millennia ago were also spoken in our own time in the African nation of Rwanda, as the ruling Hutus were in the process of wiping out their former neighbors, the Tutsi minority. One victim recalls what one of her tormentors told her. "We're going to kill all the Tutsi, and one day Hutu children will have to ask what a Tutsi child looked like." The Rape of Rwanda. The peaceful Tutsi people of Rwanda in Central Africa learned that a weapon of mass destruction could be a simple machete, used against them with lethal efficiency. The systematic slaughter of Tutsis by their former neighbors, the Hutus, spread throughout the country in a few months during the spring of 1994, as death squads killed thousands of innocent men, women, and children with machetes and nail-studded clubs. A report by the United Nations estimates that between 800,000 and a million Rwandans were murdered in about 3 months' time, making the massacre the most ferocious in recorded history. Three-quarters of the entire Tutsi population were exterminated. Hutu neighbors were slaughtering former friends and next-door neighbors on command. A Hutu murderer said in an interview a decade later that, "The worst thing about the massacre was killing my neighbor. We used to drink together. His cattle would graze on my land. He was like a relative." A Hutu mother described how she had beaten to death the children next door, who looked at her with wide-eyed amazement because they had been friends and neighbors all their lives. She reported that someone from the government had told her that the Tutsi were their enemies and had given her a club and her husband a machete to use against this threat. She justified the slaughter as doing a favor to those children, who would have become helpless orphans given that their parents had already been murdered. Until recently, there was little recognition of the systematic use of rape of these Rwandan women as a tactic of terror and spiritual annihilation. By some accounts, it began when a Hutu leader, Mayor Sylvester Kakumbibi, raped the daughter of his former friend and then had other men also rape her. She later reported that he had told her, "We won't waste bullets on you, we will rape you, and that will be worse for you." Unlike the rapes of Chinese women by Japanese soldiers in Nanking, to be described subsequently, where the details of the nightmare were blurred by failures in early reporting and the reluctance of the Chinese to relive that experience by sharing it with others, much is known about the psychological dynamics of the rape of Rwandan women. When the citizens of the village of Butare defended its borders against the onslaught of the Hutus, the interim government dispatched a special person to deal with what it considered a revolt. She was the National Minister of Family and Women's Affairs, and Butare's favorite daughter, having grown up in the area. Pauline Nyiramasuhuko, a Tutsi and former social worker who lectured on women's empowerment, was the only hope of this village. That hope was instantly shattered. Pauline supervised a terrible trap, promising the people that the Red Cross would provide food and shelter in the local stadium. In reality, armed Hutu thugs, the Interahamwe, were awaiting their arrival, eventually murdering most of the innocent sanctuary seekers. They were machine-gunned, grenades were thrown into the unsuspecting throngs, and survivors were sliced apart with machetes. Pauline gave the order that, before you kill the women, you need to rape them. She ordered another group of these thugs to burn alive a group of 70 women and girls they were guarding, and provided them with gasoline from her car to do so. Again, she invited the men to rape their victims before killing them. One of the young men told a translator that they couldn't rape them because we had been killing all day and we were tired. We just put the gasoline in bottles and scattered it among the women, then started burning. A young woman, Rose, was raped by Pauline's son, Shalom, who announced that he had permission from his mother to rape Tutsi women. She was the only Tutsi allowed to live, so she could deliver a progress report to God as the witness of the genocide. She was then forced to watch her mother being raped and 20 of her relatives slaughtered. A UN report estimated that at least 200,000 women were raped during this brief period of horror, many of them killed afterward. Some were penetrated with spears, gun barrels, bottles, or the stamens of banana trees. Sexual organs were mutilated with machetes, boiling water, and acid. Women's breasts were cut off. Page 85. Making the matter worse, the rapes, most of them committed by many men in succession, were frequently accompanied by other forms of physical torture, and often staged as public performances to multiply the terror and degradation. Page 89. They were also used as a public way of promoting social bonding among the Hutu murderers. This shared emergent camaraderie is often a byproduct of male group rape. The extent of the inhumanity knew no boundaries. A 45-year-old Rwandan woman was raped by her 12-year-old son, with Interahamwe holding a hatchet to his throat, in front of her husband, while their 5 other young children were forced to hold open her thighs. Page 116. The spread of AIDS among the living rape victims continues to wreak havoc in Rwanda. By using a disease, a plague, as an apocalyptic terror, as biological warfare, you're annihilating the procreators, perpetuating death unto generations, according to Charles Strozier, professor of history at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Page 116. How do we even begin to understand the forces that were operating to make Pauline a new kind of criminal, one woman against enemy women? A combination of history and social psychology can provide a framework based on power and status differentials. First, she was moved by the widespread sense of the lower status of the Hutu women compared with the beauty and arrogance of Tutsi women. They were taller and lighter skinned, and had more Caucasian features, which made them appear more desirable to men than Hutu women were. A racial distinction had arbitrarily been created by Belgian and German colonialists around the turn of the 20th century to distinguish between people who for centuries had intermarried, spoke the same language, and shared the same religion. They forced all Rwandans to carry identification cards that declared them to be in either the majority Hutu or the minority Tutsi, with the benefits of higher education and administrative posts going to the Tutsi. That became another source of Pauline's pent-up desire for revenge. It was also true that she was a political opportunist in a male-dominated administration, needing to prove her loyalty, obedience, and patriotic zeal to her superiors by orchestrating crimes never before perpetrated by a woman against an enemy. It also became easier to encourage the mass murders and rapes of Tutsis by being able to view them as abstractions, and also by calling them by the dehumanizing term cockroaches, which needed to be exterminated. Here is a living documentary of the hostile imagination that paints the faces of the enemy in hateful hues and then destroys the canvas. As unimaginable as it may be to any of us for someone to intentionally inspire such monstrous crimes, Nicole Bergevin, Pauline's lawyer in her genocide trial, reminds us, when you do murder trials, you realize that we are all susceptible, and you wouldn't even dream you would ever commit this act. But you come to understand that everyone is susceptible. It could happen to me, it could happen to my daughter, it could happen to you. Page 130. Highlighting even more clearly one of the main theses of this book is the considered opinion of Alison DeForge of Human Rights Watch, who has investigated many such barbarous crimes. She forces us to see our reflection mirrored in these atrocities. This behavior lies just under the surface of any of us. The simplified accounts of genocide allow distance between us and the perpetrators of genocide. They are so evil, we couldn't ever see ourselves doing the same thing. But if you consider the terrible pressure under which people were operating, then you automatically reassert their humanity, and that becomes alarming. You are forced to look at the situation and say, "What would I have done?" Sometimes the answer is not encouraging. Page 132. The French journalist Jean Hotzfeld interviewed 10 of the Hutu militia members now in prison for having macheted to death thousands of Tutsi civilians. The testimonies of these ordinary men, mostly farmers, active churchgoers, and a former teacher, are chilling in their matter-of-fact, remorseless depiction of unimaginable cruelty. Their words force us to confront the unthinkable again and again, that human beings are capable of totally abandoning their humanity for a mindless ideology, to follow and then exceed the orders of charismatic authorities to destroy everyone they label as the enemy. Let's reflect on a few of these accounts, which make Truman Capote's In Cold Blood pale in comparison. Since I was killing often, I began to feel it did not mean anything to me. I want to make clear that from the first gentleman I killed to the last, I was not sorry about a single one. We were doing a job to order. We were lining up behind everyone's enthusiasm. We gathered into teams on the soccer field and went out hunting as kindred spirits. Anyone who hesitated to kill because of feelings of sadness absolutely had to watch his mouth, to say nothing about the reason for his reticence, for fear of being accused of complicity. We killed everyone we tracked down hiding in the papyrus. We had no reason to choose, to expect or fear anyone in particular. We were cutters of acquaintances, cutters of neighbors, just plain cutters. Our Tutsi neighbors, we knew they were not guilty of no misdoing, but we thought all Tutsis at fault for our constant troubles. We no longer looked at them one by one. We no longer stopped to recognize them as they had been, not even as colleagues. They had become a threat greater than all we had experienced together, more important than our way of seeing things in the community. That's how we reasoned and how we killed at the same time. We no longer saw a human being when we turned up a Tutsi in the swamps. I mean, a person like us, sharing similar thoughts and feelings. The hunt was savage. The hunters were savage. The prey was savage. Savagery took over the mind. A particularly moving reaction to these brutal murders and rapes, which express a theme we will revisit, comes from one of the surviving Tutsi women, Berta. "Before, I knew that a man could kill another man because it happens all the time. Now I know that even the person with whom you've shared food or with whom you've slept, even he can kill you with no trouble. The closest neighbor can kill you with his teeth. That is what I've learned since the genocide, and my eyes no longer gaze the same on the face of the world." Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire has authored a powerful testimony about his experiences as the force commander for the UN assistance mission to Rwanda in Shake Hands with the Devil. Although he was able to save thousands of people by his heroic ingenuity, this top military commander was left devastated by his inability to summon more aid from the United Nations to prevent many more atrocities. He ended up with severe post-traumatic stress disorder as a psychological casualty of this massacre. The Rape of Nanking, China. So graphically horrifying, yet so easily visualized, is the concept of rape that we use the term metaphorically to describe other, almost unimaginable atrocities of war. Japanese soldiers butchered between 260,000 and 350,000 Chinese civilians in just a few bloody months of 1937. Those figures represent more deaths than the total annihilation caused by the atomic bombing of Japan and all the civilian deaths in most European countries during all of World War II. Beyond the sheer number of Chinese slaughtered, it is important for us to recognize the creatively evil ways devised by their tormentors to make even death desirable. The author Iris Chang's investigation of that horror revealed that Chinese men were used for bayonet practice and in decapitation contests. An estimated 20,000 to 80,000 women were raped. Many soldiers went beyond rape to disembowel women, slice off their breasts, and nail them to walls alive. Fathers were forced to rape their daughters, and sons their mothers, as other family members watched. War engenders cruelty and barbaric behavior against anyone considered the enemy, as the dehumanized, demonic other. The rape of Nanking is notorious for the graphic detail of the horrific extremes soldiers went to degrade and destroy innocent civilian enemy non-combatants. However, were it a singular incident and not just another part of the historical tapestry of such inhumanities against civilians, we might think it an anomaly. British troops executed and raped civilians during the U.S. Revolutionary War. Soviet Red Army soldiers raped an estimated 100,000 Berlin women toward the end of World War II, and between 1945 and 1948. In addition to the rapes and murders of more than 500 civilians at the My Lai Massacre in 1968, recently released secret Pentagon evidence describes 320 incidents of American atrocities against Vietnamese and Cambodian civilians. Dehumanization and moral disengagement in the laboratory. We can assume that most people, most of the time, are moral creatures. But imagine that this morality is like a gear shift that at times gets pushed into neutral. When that happens, morality is disengaged. If the car happens to be on an incline, car and driver move precipitously downhill. It is then the nature of the circumstances that determines outcomes, not the driver's skills or intentions. This simple analogy, I think, captures one of the central themes in the theory of moral disengagement developed by my Stanford colleague Albert Bandura. In a later chapter, we will review his theory, which will help explain why some otherwise good people can be led to do bad things. At this point, I want to turn to the experimental research that Bandura and his assistants conducted, which illustrates the ease with which morality can be disengaged by the tactic of dehumanizing a potential victim. In an elegant demonstration that shows the power of dehumanization, one single word is shown to increase aggression toward a target. Let's see how the experiment worked. Imagine you are a college student who has volunteered for a study of group problem-solving as part of a three-person team from your school. Your task is to help students from another college improve their group problem-solving performance by punishing their errors. That punishment takes the form of administering electric shocks that can be increased in severity over successive trials. After taking your names and those of the other team, the assistant leaves to tell the experimenter that the study can begin. There will be 10 trials during each of which you can decide the shock level to administer to the other student group in the next room. You don't realize that it is part of the experimental script, but you accidentally overhear the assistant complaining over the intercom to the experimenter that the other students seem like animals. You don't know it, but in two other conditions to which other students like you have been randomly assigned, the assistant describes the other students as nice guys, or does not label them at all. Do these simple labels have any effect? It doesn't seem so initially. On the first trial, all the groups respond in the same way by administering low levels of shock, around level 2. But soon it begins to matter what each group has heard about these anonymous others. If you know nothing about them, you give a steady average of about a level 5. If you have come to think of them as nice guys, you treat them in a more humane fashion, giving them significantly less shock, about a level 3. However, imagining them as animals switches off any sense of compassion you might have for them, and when they commit errors, you begin to shock them with ever-increasing levels of intensity, significantly more than in the other conditions as you steadily move up toward the high level 8. Think carefully for a moment about the psychological processes that a simple label has tripped off in your mind. You overheard a person, whom you do not know personally, tell some authority, whom you have never seen, that other college students like you seem like animals. That single descriptive term changes your mental construction of these others. It distances you from images of friendly college kids who must be more similar to you than different. That new mental set has a powerful impact on your behavior. The post hoc rationalizations the experimental students generated to explain why they needed to give so much shock to the Animal House students in the process of teaching them a good lesson were equally fascinating. This example of using controlled experimental research to investigate the underlying psychological processes that occur in significant real-world cases of violence will be extended in chapters 12 and 13 when we consider how behavioral scientists have investigated various aspects of the psychology of evil. Our ability to selectively engage and disengage our moral standards helps explain how people can be barbarically cruel in one moment and compassionate the next. Albert Bandura. Horrific images of abuse at Abu Ghraib Prison. The driving force behind this book was the need to better understand the how and why of the physical and psychological abuses perpetrated on prisoners by American military police at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. As the photographic evidence of these abuses rocketed around the world in May 2004, we all saw, for the first time in recorded history, vivid images of young American men and women engaged in unimaginable forms of torture against civilians they were supposed to be guarding. The tormentors and the tormented were captured in an extensive display of digitally documented depravity that the soldiers themselves had made during their violent escapades. Why did they create photographic evidence of such illegal acts, which, if found, would surely get them in trouble? In these trophy photos, like the proud displays by big game hunters of yesteryear with the beasts they've killed, we saw smiling men and women in the act of abusing their lowly animal creatures. The images are of punching, slapping, and kicking detainees, jumping on their feet, forcibly arranging naked, hooded prisoners in piles and pyramids, forcing naked prisoners to wear women's underwear over their heads, forcing male prisoners to masturbate or simulate fellatio while being photographed or videotaped with female soldiers smiling or encouraging it, hanging prisoners from cell rafters for extended time periods, dragging a prisoner around with a leash tied to his neck, and using unmuzzled attack dogs to frighten prisoners. The iconic image that ricocheted from that dungeon to the streets of Iraq and every corner of the globe was that of the Triangle Man. A hooded detainee is standing on a box in a stress position, with his outstretched arms protruding from under a garment blanket, revealing electrical wires attached to his fingers. He was told that he would be electrocuted if he fell off the box when his strength gave out. It did not matter that the wires went nowhere. It mattered that he believed the lie and must have experienced considerable stress. There were even more shocking photographs that the U.S. government chose not to release to the public because of the greater damage they would surely have done to the credibility and moral image of the U.S. military and President Bush's administrative command. I have seen hundreds of these images, and they are indeed horrifying. I was deeply distressed at the sight of such suffering, of such displays of arrogance, of such indifference to the humiliation being inflicted upon helpless prisoners. I was also amazed to learn that one of the abusers, a female soldier who had just turned 21, described the abuse as just fun and games. I was shocked, but I was not surprised. The media and the person in the street around the globe asked how such evil deeds could be perpetrated by these seven men and women whom military leaders had labeled as rogue soldiers and a few bad apples. Instead, I wondered what circumstances in that prison cell block could have tipped the balance and led even good soldiers to do such bad things. To be sure, advancing a situational analysis for such crimes does not excuse them or make them morally acceptable. Rather, I needed to find the meaning in this madness. I wanted to understand how it was possible for the characters of these young people to be so transformed in such a short time that they could do these unthinkable deeds. Parallel Universes in Abu Ghraib and Stanford's Prison. The reason that I was shocked but not surprised by the images and stories of prisoner abuse in the Abu Ghraib Little Shop of Horrors was that I had seen something similar before. 3 decades earlier, I had witnessed eerily similar scenes as they unfolded in a project that I directed of my own design. Naked, shackled prisoners with bags over their heads, guards stepping on prisoners' backs as they did push-ups, guards sexually humiliating prisoners, and prisoners suffering from extreme stress. Some of the visual images from my experiment are practically interchangeable with those of the guards and prisoners in that remote prison in Iraq, the notorious Abu Ghraib. The college students role-playing guards and prisoners in a mock prison experiment conducted at Stanford University in the summer of 1971 were mirrored in the real guards and real prison in the Iraq of 2003. Not only had I seen such events, I had been responsible for creating the conditions that allowed such abuses to flourish. As the project's principal investigator, I designed the experiment that randomly assigned normal, healthy, intelligent college students to enact the roles of either guards or prisoners in a realistically simulated prison setting, where they were to live and work for several weeks. My student research associates, Craig Haney, Kurt Banks, and David Jaffe, and I wanted to understand some of the dynamics operating in the psychology of imprisonment. How do ordinary people adapt to such an institutional setting? How do the power differentials between guards and prisoners play out in their daily interactions? If you put good people in a bad place, do the people triumph or does the place corrupt them? Would the violence that is endemic to most real prisons be absent in a prison filled with good, middle-class boys? These were some of the exploratory issues to be investigated in what started out as a simple study of prison life. Exploring the Dark Side of Human Nature. Our journey together will be one that the poet Milton might say leads into darkness visible. It will take us to places where evil, by any definition of the word, has flourished. We will meet a host of people who have done very bad things to others, often out of a sense of high purpose, the best ideology, and moral imperative. You are alerted to watch for demons along the path, but you may be disappointed by their banality and their similarity to your next-door neighbor. With your permission, as your adventure guide, I will invite you to walk in their shoes and see through their eyes in order to give you an insider's perspective upon evil, up close and personal. At times the view will be downright ugly, but only by examining and understanding the causes of such evil might we be able to change it, to contain it, to transform it through wise decisions and innovative communal action. The basement of Stanford University's Jordan Hall is the backdrop I will use to help you understand what it was like to be a prisoner, a guard, or a prison superintendent at that time in that special place. Although the research is widely known from media soundbites and some of our research publications, the full story has never been told. I will narrate the events as they unfold in first person, present tense, recreating the highlights of each day and night in chronological sequence. After we consider the implications of the Stanford Prison Experiment, ethical, theoretical, and practical, we will expand the bases of the psychological study of evil by exploring a range of experimental and field research by psychologists that illustrates the power of situational forces over individual behavior. We will examine in some detail research on conformity, obedience, de-individualization, dehumanization, moral disengagement, and the evil of inaction. Men are not prisoners of fate, but only prisoners of their own minds, said President Franklin Roosevelt. Prisons are metaphors for constraints on freedom, both literal and symbolic. The Stanford Prison Experiment went from initially being a symbolic prison to becoming an all-too-real one in the minds of its prisoners and guards. What are other self-imposed prisons that limit our basic freedoms? Neurotic disorders, low self-esteem, shyness, prejudice, shame, and excessive fear of terrorism are just some of the chimeras that limit our potentiality for freedom and happiness, blinding our full appreciation of the world around us. With that knowledge in mind, Abu Ghraib returns to capture our attention. But now let us go beyond the headlines and TV images to appreciate more fully what it was like to be a prison guard or a prisoner in that horrid prison at the time of those abuses. Torture forces its way into our investigation in the new forms that it has taken since the Inquisition. I will take you into the court-martial of one of those military policemen, and we will witness some of the negative fallout of the soldiers' actions. Throughout, we will bring to bear all we know about the triadic components of our social-psychological understanding, focusing on acting people in particular situations created and maintained by systemic forces. We will put on trial the command structure of the U.S. military, CIA officials, and top government leaders for their combined complicity in creating a dysfunctional system that spawned the torture and abuses of Abu Ghraib. The first part of our final chapter will offer some guidelines on how to resist unwanted social influence, how to build resistance to the seductive lures of influence professionals. We want to know how to combat mind control tactics used to compromise our freedom of choice to the tyranny of conformity, compliance, obedience, and self-doubting fears. Although I preach the power of the situation, I also endorse the power of people to act mindfully and critically as informed agents directing their behavior in purposeful ways. By understanding how social influence operates, and by realizing that any of us can be vulnerable to its subtle and pervasive powers, we can become wise and wily consumers, instead of being easily influenced by authorities, group dynamics, persuasive appeals, and compliance strategies. I want to end by reversing the question with which we started. Instead of considering whether you are capable of evil, I want you to consider whether you are capable of becoming a hero. My final argument introduces the concept of the banality of heroism. I believe that any one of us is a potential hero, waiting for the right situational moment to make the decision to act to help others despite personal risk and sacrifice. But we have far to travel before we get to that happy conclusion. So, andiamo. Power said to the world, "You are mine." The world kept it prisoner on her throne. Love said to the world, "I am thine." The world gave it the freedom of her house. Rabindranath Tagore, Stray Birds.